Right, folks, we're going to carry on with Colossians, our study in Colossians this morning. And we're looking at connecting to work. We're going to have our SMS questions as well. So please, as I'm going through this morning, please feel free to SMS your questions. We'll be taking them a little bit later on. We'll have a time for questions and also a time for prayer for folk who really need prayer in this regard. We're going to have a look at Colossians chapter 3, and I'm going to read from verse 22. Before I do, I just want to give you a quote from a man by the name of Bertram Lewis. He said, "Unless the job means more than the pay, it will never pay more." Unless the job means more than the pay, it will never pay more. And I just want you to just have that saying in the back of your mind as I work through the scriptures this morning. You'll begin to see how relevant it is. So let's just have a look at Colossians chapter 3. I'll read from verse 22. "Slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, do your work heartily, as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. It is the Lord Christ whom you serve. For he who does wrong will receive the consequences of the wrong which he has done, and that without partiality. Masters, grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master in heaven." And now I just want you to turn back a few pages to Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 6. And I'm going to read there from verse 5. "Slaves, obey your masters here on earth with fear and respect and from a sincere heart, just as you obey Christ. You must do this not only while they're watching you to please them. With all your heart, you must do what God wants as people who are obeying Christ. Do your work with enthusiasm. Work as if you were serving the Lord, not as if you were serving only men and women. Remember that the Lord will give a reward to everyone, slave or free, for doing good. Masters, in the same way, be good to your slaves. Do not threaten them. Remember that the one who is your master and their master is in heaven, and he treats everyone alike." Now, those two scriptures, interestingly enough, tell you the same story. Isn't that so? And I've never really seen it before. One tends to read from the book of Ephesians and you read other sections. You don't realize that Paul has actually copied what he wrote before. He was actually writing to the Ephesian church as well and in the same way. Now, just to give you a bit of background to this letter, in the recent weeks we've been going through the theology of Colossians, and we've seen that essentially Paul wrote this letter to the church at Colossae to counteract some doctrinal error that had crept in. They were having a lot of Judaistic teaching was coming back into the church, and it was being mixed with Oriental philosophy. And with the result that they were introducing a whole lot of rituals and rules, and in fact were bringing a bit of Gnosticism into the church. We've heard all that before as well. And what was happening was that the supremacy of Jesus was being obscured and just clouded over. And they were getting into empty religion. And so Paul, who was in prison at the time, he wrote this letter at about the same time as he wrote the letter to the Ephesian church. And the two letters, when you read them, are very similar in thought and language, except that the Ephesian letter focused on the church as the body of Christ, whereas this particular letter focuses on Christ, the head of the church. Okay, bit of background about the letter. The city of Colossae was located in what is today called Turkey, modern-day Turkey. In those days, Asia Minor. It was a few miles east of another town which we've seen in the Bible called Laodicea. And there was a big trading route that ran between Ephesus and the Euphrates. And Colossae was smack in the middle of that. So it was a very prominent city, very prosperous. People were quite wealthy there at the time. And Colossae remained there and was quite prosperous until about the 8th century when the trade route was changed. I think someone built a double highway and bypassed the town. And so it didn't make quite so much money anymore, which we see happening quite often these days. And then in the 12th century, the Turks came along and they destroyed the city, left it in ruins, and never built again. So a bit of an historical background. This part of the world was dominated by Greek and Roman culture and tradition and philosophy. So when Paul wrote this letter, he was writing to people who understood the Greek-Roman scene. They didn't really understand anything else. It had been around for centuries. And so with that in mind, I want to give you a bit of a background into the historical worldview of work and employment, putting up a slide, which I'm just going to take you through quite quickly. Essentially, just a historical worldview of work and employment. We start off with the traditional Hebrew view. The Hebrews didn't like work. They believed it was a curse from God because of Adam and Eve's sin. Okay? I tend to agree with them. I don't like work. But that was their traditional viewpoint. But when we read through the Old Testament scriptures, we find that the Hebrews realized that work was appropriate. Work was necessary. If you wanted to live, you needed to do some work. And so that was their viewpoint. Generally speaking, we don't like it. It's a curse, but we have to do it, and so we do. All right, so that was the traditional Hebrew view. Then the Greeks and the Romans, well, the classical Greek and Roman view was quite different. Generally speaking, the only people that worked at that time were slaves. And the only reason they worked was because they got beaten if they didn't. They got beaten, or they got sold, or they got killed, or they got tortured, all sorts of things. As far as the free people were concerned, the free Greeks and Romans, work was just not on. The ideal for the Greeks and the Romans was a time of leisure. So lying around in the baths, cruising to the countryside to enjoy your estates and have all your servants waiting on you, that was the classical Greek and Roman view. In fact, the Greeks were so bad, they believed that working was subverting the state. That ultimately leaders, the top leaders, should never do any work. That was the classical view. And this is the age, this is the understanding that Paul was writing into at both Colossae and at Ephesus. Then we come to, and by the way, the classical Greek and Roman view was very much focused on self. On self. It was all about looking after yourself, self-aggrandizement, self-accomplishment, self-expression, and luxury for oneself. Then we come to an age in history called the Middle Ages, which runs from about 400 to 1400 AD, about 1,000 years, just after the church became the official religion of the Roman Empire at the hands of Constantine. Now, in the Middle Ages, they had a mix, effectively, of Hebrew tradition, classical Greek and Roman, and also Christian thought. Because remember, there'd been 400 years of Christian teaching throughout Europe. This letter, the words to the Colossian church and to the Ephesian church, would have been filtering into churches throughout Europe. But what they did was, in the Middle Ages, they mixed the two. So effectively, they said, listen, work is still a curse, still bad news, we don't like it. But the Christian view is, if you work, you're going to do all right. You're going to be able to support yourself. So we had that mix. But ultimately, there was one Christian view that came through, is that whatever you do is as unto the Lord. As unto the Lord. And so there was still a focus on God. It was still a little bit of self, but the Middle Ages was becoming more of a focus on whatever you were doing was for God. And then we come to an age in history called the Reformation, and the beginning of what's called the Protestant ethic. Now, the Reformation was round about the 15th, 14th, and 15th century it began. And essentially, there were two men responsible for a change in people's thinking, and that was Martin Luther and John Calvin. Now, Martin Luther had a very clear view of work. It was simply a service unto God. Work was every Christian's sacred duty. And it was to be done wholeheartedly as unto the Lord. But Luther didn't believe in commerce. He believed that the hoarding of wealth was actually sinful. And he simply said to people, get out there and work with all your might. He believed in manual labor. And he rated serving in the church the highest and the noblest profession. He also said that people who get into a certain profession must stay there. They mustn't move out of their chosen occupation, and they must do it extremely well. John Calvin came along, and he took it one step further. He said, no, what I want you to do is I want you to work incredibly hard. I want you to make lots and lots of money, and then I want you to give it all away. So John Calvin, in fact, could be said to be the father of modern capitalism. He believed that all work was sacred as unto the Lord. The focus of work was to be on God. And everything was focused around that. Exactly what Paul says in this letter to the Colossians. Whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord and not to men. But Calvin said, get out there, make it happen, be prosperous, so that there would be no poor among you. The idea was that you would generate lots and lots of money and you'd be able to use it to further the gospel and to help others. So that became something that was captured the hearts of many people. And we had a number of groups. We had a number of Protestant groups, the Huguenots, people who came from France, the Puritans, the Quakers. These guys worked as if for God. Everything they did was for the Lord. And what they used to do was go out and create incredible businesses. Some of them are standing today. Some of those businesses that were founded are still in existence today. Now, that particular time, the Protestant ethic, what was very interesting was that businesses became entrenched in society. People were employed. People became more prosperous. It was almost as if by serving the Lord, there was a blessing which flowed. Okay? It's a very interesting thing to notice, and you'll see it a little bit further on as well. Essentially, I could summarize the norms like this. The Protestant ethic encouraged work in a chosen occupation with an attitude of service to God. It viewed work as a calling. It avoided placing greater spiritual dignity on one job than another. It approved of working diligently to achieve maximum profits. It required the reinvestment of the profits back into the business, allowed a person to change from craft or profession of his father, and associated your success in your work with the likelihood of being one of God's elect. John Calvin believed that if you worked hard and you were prosperous and you were blessed by God, it was a sign of your election as a Christian. So what we had was this incredible work ethic, and it dominated most of Europe and eventually became secularized. So what started off as a Christian thing, with guys working hard as for God, the idea of working hard continued, but it was no longer for God, it became for self. But interestingly enough, we see that the whole of Europe became prosperous. And that led us to the Industrial Age, which is at the end of the 18th and into the 19th century. Now, the Industrial Age was where machines replaced a lot of manual labor. So we had huge factories being created, lots of machines being put in place, and people working in those factories just became digits. They were just numbers sitting in an assembly line. And they would be given little tasks to do, so they'd get to work. They'd have one task to do, and they'd do it all day, and then they'd go home. They didn't have to think about what they did. There was no encouragement to better themselves. It was simply a case of do what you're told. And that's what happened. So that seriously affected this work ethic that was begun by the early Protestant fathers. And the sense of control over your destiny was missing. And the factory system also threatened the promise of economic reward. Because what happened was the factory started making more and more goods for less and less people, with the result that we see that today. Somebody makes a television set, somebody makes another one that's slightly better, slightly bigger, and so we go on. And they continue to make new and newer models, encouraging people to buy them. But eventually what happens is they made more stuff than what people could buy. And so the factories got into trouble and they had to lay off people, and we had something that's crept into society called unemployment. All right. So that's a picture of the Industrial Age. And then we moved on. The industrial age was still, to a large degree, focused on what you did was done as unto the Lord, but it was starting to move towards focus on self. We come now to the information age, which is the age in which we live. Okay? And that basically started in the early 20th century and has moved right through until this very day. The difference between the two, the information and industrial age, the industrial age is known as a low discretion age. People didn't have to think too much. There wasn't much opportunity for innovation and initiation. Whereas in the information age, people are encouraged to be innovative, to think for themselves, to do things. But ultimately what happened was this work ethic became something quite powerful. But the aim of the work ethic was self, self-expression, self-development, and not God. So we've seen a full circle from the classical age, which was all about self, right round through God, and back to self again. The summary, just to summarize this worldview, like many things in life, what starts off as focus on God becomes focus on self, becomes secularized. And today we have a situation where we have a thing called careerism. Careerism. In a book called Modern Madness by Douglas LeBeer, he said, careerism has become the main work ethic of our time. At root, careerism is an attitude, a life orientation in which a person views his career as the primary and most important aim of life. Just think about it for a minute. Today, in the workplace, people are out to get a career. I go to school, I go to university to get a career. Once I've got that career, I've got a good job, lots of money. That's my focus. That's what drives me all the way through my career. And I raise my children, go to school, go to university, get a good job, have a great career, make lots of money, and perpetuate that. Never once do we say, whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. Whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. So, that's a background to the historical work view. Just I want you to bear some of those things in mind, how that Protestant ethic began, and then what has happened subsequently. Now, what is the biblical view of work? Well, it's quite interesting. When God created the heavens and the earth and everything in it, God was actually doing something. He was working. All right? His purpose was to enjoy his own glory in everything that he did. After each thing that he made, the Bible tells us, he made it, and he saw that it was good. So he did it, he worked, he created something, he stepped back, he had a look at it. Wow. Great. And that's, whenever he did something, he got great satisfaction from it, great pleasure from it, and we can quite clearly say that God began the whole work thing himself. So work is a God thing. Work is a good thing, but it's also a God thing. In Genesis 2:2, it says, by the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing, so he rested from all his work. Now, we know that we were made in God's image. In fact, man is the ultimate manifestation of God's glory on the earth. And we were made in every way to be in his image, without his divinity, of course. But God intended that everything man was to do, to grow, to govern, to fill, and to rule the earth, was to be for God's glory. In Genesis 2:15, the scripture says, Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden, to work it and take care of it. So what I can pick up from those early scriptures is that if work was good enough for God, it's good enough for me. All right? Much as I don't like it, it's good enough for God, it's good enough for me. Now, when you go through the Old Testament scriptures, you'll find lots and lots of scriptures about work and about laziness, about diligence and idleness, about the diligent and the sluggard, as the scripture refers to the lazy person. But one of the things that you begin to see flowing through all the scriptures is that work is honorable, work is good, it gives satisfaction. it should involve rest, and it produces results. When God made the heavens and the earth, it was to his glory. When he made these things, he saw that it was good. It gave him great satisfaction. And when he was finished it, he rested from all his work. But there were results from it. There were results from it. Man and woman was created, the animals, this earth in which we live, and everything we were created for was to manifest the glory of God on this earth. Now, the Bible doesn't actually tell us that we need to work for a living. It doesn't say, thou shalt work for a living. All right? But the Bible does imply that work is appropriate. It's necessary. As I said to you, Paul grew up in this environment as a Hebrew. Knowing the Old Testament scriptures, he would have been very clear that idleness was actually almost a sin. And so when he wrote this letter to the Colossian church, he was conscious of this Greek-Roman attitude to work. He spoke directly to the situation. Another example of the Bible's relevance to this thing of work is actually in the words of Jesus himself. In his great prayer to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, John 17, verse 4, he said, Father, I glorified you on the earth, having accomplished the work that you've given me to do. Jesus' work was to glorify God on the earth. And so what he did was, he did that work, and then he said, Father, I've done it. I've done it. I've glorified you. And so the purpose of Jesus is the same as our purpose. Whatever we do is to the glory of God. Paul wrote that in his letter to the Corinthians. He said, whatever you do, do as unto the glory of God. But now, what's the relevance of this to our modern world? Remember, Paul's writing to these Greeks and Romans in Turkey, and it's 2,000 years ago. It's completely different to where we are now. But what is it about today? Well, the difference today is that work is more associated with money. If you think about work, you think about money. Isn't that right? How many people are quite happy to go and work for nothing? Yeah. There's a few of you, all right? And I know you do. But most of us would think very carefully about working without being paid for it. And you can't work unless there's business, because you either own the business or somebody employs you. Isn't that right? So it's very important that we understand that. Work, in this context, is the key to success in business. If you don't work hard, you've got a problem. And Proverbs 10:4 says, he becomes poor who works with a slack and idle hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. So, simple. Don't work, poor. Work, rich. Simple? Not so simple. Some of us work incredibly hard and we never seem to get rich. Others never seem to do anything and they get rich. I've never fully understood that one. But I believe that in the long term, over time, God's blessing, like all of these things, time is a wonderful way. God's blessing comes in time. And there's Proverbs that says here that wealth that is gained too quickly soon dissipates. Another proverb says that little by little, you grow your wealth. So it's taking time. It means you work hard at it. And it develops like that, and God blesses it. Let's look at some of the characteristics of work today. First of all, we've got a growing leisure industry. A growing leisure industry. In some countries, they're agitating for a 30-hour week. I think France are working a 30-hour week. They want the same pay and the same benefits, but less hours. And you look around you, you buy magazines, you go out there and just drive around, see the billboards, watch the adverts on TV. It's about timeshare. It's about international travel. It's about hotels. It's about cycling and golf and skiing and everything to do with leisure. Isn't that right? If you just step back for a minute and just think, 21st century, November 2010, when I think about all the stuff going on around me, Everything is promoting leisure, 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 leisure. They don't actually say to you, listen, before you can come on this holiday, you have to work incredibly hard to make enough money to go on the holiday. No, no. What they say to you is, go on holiday now, use your credit card to pay for it, and then you can work incredibly hard later to pay for it. But you see, most people don't worry about the work because they're just caught up in it. They're caught up in this thing. The second thing that we've got, and oh, and by the way, this leisure industry is all about self. It's about being comfortable. It's about having a nice time. It's about going to different countries and meeting different people and enjoying different things. It's about being leisurely. Isn't that right? But it's all about self. It's all focusing on self. It's not about God. The second thing that we have in our modern time is technology. We've got technology today that almost means you don't have to work. I can actually work anywhere in the world right now doing what I do. All I need is a laptop, a cell phone, and a modem. And I can do my job anywhere in the world. In fact, I can work, as long as I can get cell phone reception, I can work at the top of the Drakensberg Mountains, and I can help somebody in London, New York, San Francisco, wherever it might be. As long as they speak English, it'll be fine. Technology has helped us enormously. But technology has also meant that some people don't have to work, almost. And so what happens is they become idle. And idle hands can lead to sin. And this is what the early Protestant fathers were very keen to speak into people's lives about. They said, guys, if you are not working hard, if you are loafing and lying around, Paul was doing this as well with the Greeks and the Romans. He's saying, whatever you're doing, you must work heartily. You can easily drift into sin. Temptation can come, and it's too easy for that to happen. Another thing that we have in a modern context is unemployment. We've got this thing called unemployment. And there are huge numbers of people that are unemployed, especially in the developing world. In South Africa, our official unemployment rate is about 25%. I believe in the age group up to 25, it's about 70% of young people. You young guys, 70% are unemployed. Now, I want to say something to you that I think is very, very important. And you need to hear me on this one. There's a very big difference between being unemployed and not working. All right? Let me say that again. It's a big difference between being unemployed and not working. Employment has to do with the job. And within that job, you will have work to do. Okay, but if you don't have a job, that doesn't mean that you don't have to work. You can still work. And I'll explain that in a little more detail just now. A couple of years, probably about 5 or so years ago, I was very involved with Project Gateway in the city. And I was involved with them for about 14 years. And on one of these particular days, the executive of Gateway went out to visit an informal settlement area out somewhere around Copesville area. And this informal settlement had been in existence for about 30 years, a long time. And as we walked around there, we were with one of the city pastors, looking for ways to help the people that were in that particular settlement. And the one thing that I became conscious of as we walked around there was it was incredibly poor, destitute. There were signs of hopelessness and despair. I was very conscious of it. And at first your heart goes out and you think, man, what can we do to help these people? But after a while, I was looking around and I saw the verges of all the roads were covered with refuse, plastic packets, tins, bottles that had been chucked out there. I saw more and more little vegetable gardens that had been started but were now overgrown with weeds, fences that were broken down, bits and pieces of things lying around. And then I began to notice that sitting outside the doorway of each house was usually a man, not a woman, just lazing there in the sun. And I thought to myself, this is just not good enough. These men are not working because they don't have jobs. They're not working because they're unemployed. But that doesn't mean they can't work. Now, I know I'm not trying to minimize the effects that poverty has. If you're poor and you haven't eaten for days, you don't have a lot of energy for manual labor. Let's not kid ourselves. And if you've been looking for a job for months and months and months and you haven't been able to get one, you can be in the depths of despair, the sense of hopelessness. The proverb says, hope deferred makes the heart sick. If you've been trying and trying and trying and nothing happens, you just sit there. You feel, what's the point? But folks, it's not a poverty issue. It's not a poverty issue. It's a leadership issue. It just needs one leader to stand up there and say to the people, come on, guys. Let's start by cleaning up the roads. We can pick up the papers. We can pick up the bottles. We can fix the fences. We can dig up the soil where we've had those vegetable gardens. We can plant new seed. We can put new crops in there. We can water that. It just needs some leadership. And it's very, very important that we understand this. Because you know what happens when you start to work? And when you've finished, and you've picked up all the papers, and you've picked up all the bottles, and you've cleaned up your vegetable gardens, and you look at it, and it is good. Like God, when He finished creating, you look at it and you say, it's good. And it gives you satisfaction. And when it gives you satisfaction, it restores the dignity that you've lost through being fired or laid off or whatever it might have been that caused you not to have a job. Unemployed doesn't mean you have to stop working. It's a perverse leadership that can't find something for their people to do. We met the leader of that informal settlement, and he was also sitting on his porch. And as far as I was concerned, that was just appalling. But it needs somebody to grab hold of them and say, come on. Come on, let's do this. We can do it. And folks, you don't need money to do that. It doesn't cost money to walk up the road with a packet and pick up all the rubbish. Another thing that we have in our modern work society is a culture of entitlement. We have a situation today where people believe that they have a right to be employed. They have a right to be paid, whether they work or not. If they have a career, if they're called a teacher, if they're called a doctor, if they're called an accountant, they need to be paid according to what they are called. And society has determined that the man who sweeps the streets earns very little money, and the man who's the neurosurgeon earns more money than he can possibly imagine. That's what the world has determined. Culture of entitlement. Thomas Paine said, that which we obtain too easily, we esteem too lightly. In this culture of entitlement, people will say that if you pitch up for work, you have a right to be paid, whether you work or not. The responsibility to make people work rests with the employer and not with the employee. For many other people, no work is done unless there's a promise of reward. Remember the question I asked you earlier? How many of you would work for nothing? Well, most of us wouldn't be too happy about working for nothing. There's a culture of entitlement. And another thing we have is this modern version of the Protestant work ethic. And I've heard, I work with a lot of smaller businesses, and there's a common complaint out there in the marketplace. They say, there's no work ethic anymore. That's the problem with this country. Nobody wants to work anymore. But you see, what Paul was addressing wasn't the fact that people needed to work hard, but that they needed to work hard as for the Lord. Okay. The modern work ethic does not add on those last few words. It is all about, we want you to work hard. Full stop. Now, this modern work ethic has come out of that original Protestant work ethic. And most of the business in this country In this country, most of the business that's around has been developed as capitalist business. It has a Western orientation, and most Western-oriented business, capitalist business, that's been developed over the years has been developed on the back of those early work pioneers, people who emigrated out of Europe into America and all around the world. They took with them this incredible desire to please God. In a book called Make a Life and Not Just a Living, the author says this: America was founded on the shoulders of enterprising Jewish, Scottish, Protestant, and Italian Catholic immigrants, all of whom believed their work mattered to God. They saw their lives as much more than simply being busy and bringing home a paycheck. In fact, work was a fundamental dimension of their very existence. Work to these individuals was a moral imperative that was the key to the word ethic in work ethic. These people saw their work as a gift to God and their task as ultimately working for God. Now that was the foundation on which Western capitalism was built. It's gone all sorts of ways after that, but that was a foundation, and it was a very powerful foundation. I've got a little table I want to put up for you just to show you how the original time-honored view of work looked compared to the growing view of work. The first thing we notice is that work in the time-honored way was part of a calling or vocation. Those early Christians believed that their work was a calling from God. The growing view of work is that work is just my occupation. It's my career. The time-honored view of work, the second one, is that the workplace was a place to reflect right values. I can actually demonstrate Christ in me, the hope of glory, through my work. In the growing view of work, it's a place just to get what you want. The time-honored view of work focuses on giving, whereas the current view focuses on getting. Money, time off, perks, me, me, me. Everything for self. The time-honored view of work, the workplace is a vital and exciting place to be because it's there you could give expression to what God has created in each one of us. Today, it's just the place to get the salary that's needed for life. And then lastly, the time-honored view of work meant that it was an ennobling occupation. And the growing view of work is that it's just a means to an end. Just a means to an end. So you can see, although the ethic, the thing about working hard, hasn't changed, the focus has changed completely. And for us as Christians, folks, that's what I want you to grasp hold of. So now we come back. That's my introduction. Now we come back to what Paul had to say in that scripture in Colossians chapter 3. Remember what I said, Paul was brought up in the Hebrew tradition. They were told from very young that you have to work to support yourself, to support your family. But remember, work is a curse. But as a Christian, Paul had a completely different view of it. He suddenly saw, yes, whatever I do as unto the glory of God. So work is no longer seen as a curse, but actually an opportunity to display the glory of God to people around you. In fact, working hard promotes the gospel. In fact, Christians who work hard are the gospel. You are the good news. So what Paul does is, and I'm going to break this up into three sections. The first thing he says in Colossians 3, he says, whatever you do. Okay? He doesn't say whatever work you do. He says, whatever you do. Because this little word work very often is confused with jobs. I really want you to get that into your heads this morning. It's not just about jobs. I'm not talking about employment. Whatever you do, he says, you do as unto the Lord. Now, in this particular instance, the context of it, Paul is writing to the Colossian church, but he starts off by addressing the slaves. Why? Remember the classical Greek and Roman time they live in? The only people who worked were slaves. The free men never worked because the slaves did all the work. So what we have here is a situation where we have a church in the city that is made up of slaves and freedmen together. Now the slaves have become Christians and the freedmen have become Christians. So suddenly their relationship has changed. Wow. The slaves are thinking to themselves, I'm now the same as you. You're my boss, but you were formerly my master, but now we're both Christians. We're brothers. Now you imagine the shock in that kind of environment. We're now brothers. So what was happening? The slaves were looking at the masters and they were saying, you guys are loafing around and taking things easy. Why can't we? And of course the masters were now a little bit concerned because they're sitting in the, and this guy's sitting next to me in church now. He's formerly my slave. If he didn't do what I asked him, I was to beat him. Now he sits next to me. In fact, he even hugs me. And suddenly the master's confused by this. Now what do I do? I'm a Christian. And that's when Paul goes on and he says, masters, treat your slaves with respect. He doesn't say, set your slaves free. He says, treat them with respect. Treat them decently, fairly. And Paul goes on to say, because their master is the same as your master, God in heaven. Christ is the same for each of you. He doesn't address the disparity, the master, the employer-employee relationship. He doesn't break that up. But he says, whatever you do. You see, and Dave said this a couple of weeks ago when he was preaching on the centrality or the supremacy of Jesus. Christianity is not a religion. It's not some new set of rules. It's a person. It's Jesus. And what Paul is doing is he's pointing them back to Jesus all the time. He's saying, it's Christ whom you serve. In 1 Corinthians 10:31, Paul went on to write to the Corinthian church. He said, whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So whatever your hand turns to, let it be for the sake of Christ. Christian slaves would relate that to the work they performed on a daily basis. And that would be cleaning the house, drawing the water, making fires, cooking, washing clothes, etc., working in the fields. But one thing that Paul reminded them of is that their masters are still their masters. Their employers are still their employers. And there's an authority there that is God-ordained. Romans 13 says that all authority on earth has been established by God. So he's reminding them, guys, you may be slaves. Now you're Christians. In my sight, you're free and you're the same. But there's an employer-employee relationship that you're still to honor. And what he goes on to say to them is, guys, I want you to work for these masters as if they're not there. When they're not there, it's as if you're working for God. So it's the Lord who's watching you and what you're doing. The second thing that Paul says is, whatever you do, you're to do it heartily. Do it heartily. And this means vigorously, exuberantly, thoroughly, completely, seeing something through with a whole heart, completely. And there's an aspect of joy to it in the way he says it. And just a personal example, as a very much younger man, a long time ago, when Debs and I, in fact, before we were married and just after we were married, I had a habit of starting something and not finishing it. I had lots of ideas, and I would get stuck into something, and then it might get a little bit tough, and I had enough of that, and I'd move on. You see, with the result that I had quite a lot of unfinished business around. But as the years go, my father-in-law, who's still alive, he is a Scot, and he was raised in the true Calvinist tradition, to work hard and to do it incredibly well. And what happened over time was that he began to teach me to see things through. Not that he pulled me aside and said, now listen, you must do this. But I just watched him. Everything he started, he finished. Everything he finished, he did well. He did it incredibly well. Now, he didn't have much of an education, primary school. In fact, he was a locomotive driver on the Zimbabwe Railways until the day he retired. So he didn't earn very much. But if you went to his home, the garden was immaculate. His car was always well serviced. When he went to work, he was clean. When he came home from work, he was clean. His locomotive that he drove used to shine. You could eat your food off the plate, the foot plate. In fact, he used to say that. My foot plate's not clean enough to eat off and hasn't been cleaned properly. So there was something in that desire to do hard work that really came through. And that really challenged me hugely. Now, his motives might not have been as unto the Lord, but I want you to understand that he grew up in that tradition. It was something that was passed down from generation to generation to generation. It was sick. It wasn't even worth thinking about. There's only one way to do the work, and that is heartily. And that's what he did. And then thirdly, Paul says, whatever you do, do it heartily, but as to the Lord and not to men. Now, in my business, I've made it a practice when employing people to say this to them. I've said, our business hours are between 8 and 5, and 8 and 4:30. But I said, I want you to understand something. I don't watch the clock. If you arrive late, that's your problem. If you go home early, that's your problem. Ultimately, you're not working for me. You're working for the Lord. All the people that work for me are Christians. So I've said to them, I want you to understand the scripture in Colossians 3. Ultimately, whatever you do is as unto the Lord. It's not for me. All I ask as the employer is that the job that needs to get done gets done. And what I ask is that you do it well. If you're going to do something, why not do it well? I mean, think about it for a minute. If you're going to spend an hour doing something, you might as well do it well as not. And yet some people still think that they can do a job half-heartedly. Now, I'm not in my workplace every day, but Jesus is. He's there in every person that works there. He's with them. He's in that place. He inhabits it. If they don't work, it's him that's watching, not me. In Matthew 6:33, it says, seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. I have a sense that if you look back in history, the most prosperous, and one could say the most blessed time, has been, if we equate blessing with material gain, then certainly the Western environment has been the most prosperous in history over time. I believe that the intentions and the motives and the aims of those early Protestant fathers was what set the foundation for that prosperity. Now, I'm not here to preach prosperity, but I have a sense that woven into the themes of the Bible about work is that as you first seek his kingdom, as you do everything for him, as you focus on as unto the Lord and not for men, and you work heartily, there's a blessing that follows. Isn't that right? There's a blessing that follows. All these other things shall be added to you. Very important. And Paul carries on. He says, there's a reward for doing this. It's called the reward of the inheritance. And I thought, the reward of the inheritance. Now, what can that be? But you see what it is? It doesn't matter what you do. The humblest work. You may be a gardener. You may be a domestic servant. You may just iron clothes for a living. You may be a cook. It doesn't matter what you do. It can be glorified and dignified by doing it for the Lord. It doesn't matter what it is. Remember, in the world system, we have created something where we value people by what they do, by what they do, not by who they are. We need to understand that. In the kingdom of God, it doesn't matter what you do. It's how you do it. And the reward of the inheritance, apart from the fact that there will be temporal rewards, your rewards in heaven won't be for prominence or success. They will not be for talent or opportunity. They will be for faithfulness. Faithfulness in whatever you did. And I just want to take a few minutes here to honor my wife. And might be a little difficult for me because I always get emotional about things like this. But I've been married for 36 years. And in that time, when we first got married, Debs was working for a bank. And once the children were born, she stopped doing that. And Debs has worked at home ever since. And I know quite often we have met people who've seemed to have these amazing careers, advocates, doctors, women folk. And I know she's asked me on occasion, don't you think, wouldn't it have been better if you'd been married to somebody who had an amazing career? And I used to think to myself, you have no idea what you're talking about. You are the most amazing woman. Debs, no matter what she does it excellently. Excellently. If you come to our home, you will see it. You will see it in the home itself. You will see it in the little things. And I want to give you an example. She packs a lunch for me every day. And it's a plastic tub. Okay? I open the plastic tub, and I'm onto salads now. I'm trying to lose weight. So inside this plastic tub is this amazing salad. Now, it's not just a bunch of leaves and stuff that's been rammed in there. It's each leaf has been lovingly broken up. On top of that, the tomatoes have been cut into slices. There's feta cheese. There's a bit of olives. There's this chicken broken up. It's the most, it's amazing. It's a work of art. It's a work of art. And I think to myself, it's just today's lunch, but it's been done, I believe, as unto the Lord. It's not to please me. And her whole life's been like that. So I'm awed by it. And it's the faithfulness. It's the life of service. If you had to talk to my two daughters, they would just say, Mom is awesome. Now, you might not be a doctor or an advocate or a lawyer or an accountant or one of these things. But that's irrelevant because what you do so well. You do it so well. Heartily as for the Lord rather than for men. And you see, this faithfulness one day has a reward, ultimate reward. You'll stand before the Lord Jesus Christ and you will hear him say, well done, good and faithful servant. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many. Now enter into the joy of your master. Wow. I think to myself, imagine doing that. I've been going on for quite a long time. Folks, I want to run through just three R's for you in this. Some practical steps for change, because I need to relate it to where we are right now. The first thing I want to ask you to do is to reflect. Reflect. Just, in fact, right now, just close your eyes. I want you to reflect on your lives. I want you to think, what are the things that you do? What's your attitude to work and to money? How well are you doing these things? Are you seeing them through? Do you genuinely see whatever you do as for the Lord? Or are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it because you believe you have to survive? Can you do these things better? Can you do them better? Can you change your focus? Now, if this, all right, you can look back at me. If this kind of reflection surprised you, because it surprised me, I suddenly realized, yes, I do work hard. I work hard and I work fairly long hours, but I realized that a lot of it is not as unto the Lord. It's make sure my business, make sure I have enough revenue at the end of the month, make sure I have enough money in the bank account. But it's as unto the Lord. I had to catch myself and I realized, and I prayed. I said, Father, thank you that you've shown me this. And I've got a completely different way of looking at my work right now. So reflect. Secondly, I want you to reform. Reform. You might have got into some bad habits over the years, and there's lots of reasons for this. You could find yourself in a demeaning job that does nothing for your dignity or your bank account. You find yourself unemployed after months and months of looking for a job. You've given up. You now lie around on a couch watching TV programs. You just feel dreadful. You got into a habit of stealing money, time, things. Christians, too, do it. And we live in a culture and an age of entitlement. In this country alone, the example that's set to us by our leaders is not a great one. Out of 535 people sitting in Parliament right now, 70% of them have been charged with some form of criminal charge. To give an example, 29 have been accused of spousal abuse, 7 arrested for fraud, 19 for writing bad checks, 3 for assault have actually done jail time, 71 can't get credit card because they've got bad credit ratings, 14 have been arrested on drug-related charges, 8 have been arrested for shoplifting, 84 for drunk driving in the last year. These are the leaders of our nation. Reform. They need to stop it. Paul writes to the Ephesians in chapter 4, verse 28. He says, those who are stealing must stop stealing and start working. They should earn an honest living for themselves. I think those words are very clear. There's nothing ambiguous about it, isn't there? Are you stealing? Stop it. Stop it. You need to start working. Earn an honest living for yourself. In his letter to the Thessalonians, he actually tells Christians that if there are Christians in our midst, so he would be writing to us, he'd say, okay, you guys, if there's anybody here who's lazy, anybody here who's lazy, don't associate with them. Wow. Don't associate with them. What does that mean? It doesn't mean you shun them, but there's a whole other process involved in it. But what he's saying is, if you associate with these lazy people, you will become lazy. So find out who the hard workers are, strap yourself onto them, and copy them. Let them model a lifestyle for you. That scripture, if you want to read it, it's in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 6 to 12. It's very, very clear. He goes on to say, anyone who refuses to work should not eat. So he's almost saying, in this church, any one of you is not working, he's not going to get any food. There's a number of very good scriptures in Proverbs. I'm just going to take you to one of them. And I want to show you a picture. Would you put that picture up of that little baby? It's the most beautiful picture. She's fast asleep, this child. 19 verse 24 says, though the lazy person puts his hand in the dish, he can't lift the food to his mouth. Now, she's not lazy, but I got that picture just to give an idea. Can you imagine someone, he's so idle. He's sitting on the table and he's got his food in the dish, but he's too lazy to even bring it up to his mouth. Paul goes on in the Galatians letter, he says, carry your own burdens, lest don't be a burden to other people. That's why we work. And then the third one, resolve. Resolve to work hard. Paul did this a lot. You know, when he went on his missionary journeys, he stopped in Corinth, he stayed with Aquila and Priscilla. In chapter 18, verse 3, it says, because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and they were working. For by trade they were tent makers. Paul didn't go along and stay with Aquila and Priscilla, and then he lay in bed and that night he preached to the church. No. He went and worked with them. He made sure that he was not a burden to them. When he got to Ephesus in 1925, Acts 1925, he says, he gathered together with workmen of similar trades and said, men, you know that our prosperity depends on this business. He was saying to them, guys, if we want to make some money in order to live, it depends on what we do, this hard work. In 20 verse 35, he's leaving Ephesus. He's saying goodbye to the leaders there. He's not going to see them again. And he says, and everything I showed you, that by working hard in this manner, you must help the weak. Paul demonstrated what it meant to work hard and unto the Lord. And there was a reason for that. I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to open this to questions. I've actually got a couple of questions and answers myself written down, and I want to see if some of these will come out from the group. If any of you have got your cell phones, do we have any question? Okay, sure. I just want to read to you from 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. Paul is writing to the Thessalonians, and he said, for you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. How did he proclaim the gospel of God? By working hard night and day. He was showing these classical Greco-Roman Hebrews that working hard as unto the Lord was what pleases God and what gives him glory. Okay, question. What about people who can't work because of a disability, I don't think it's right for us to look down on them. Absolutely, it's not right for us to look down on them. But people who have a disability, I think the different levels of disability, okay? If you are mentally disabled, where you literally can't do anything for yourself, you are alive, but that's all, and someone's caring for you, then, you know, I really don't believe it's applicable. If you are disabled in a way that you can think, you can talk, you can read, you can write, you can move your hands, I've often said that in my kind of work with technology today, as long as I have a head and I can move these fingers on my computer, I can work. So even if the rest of my body was paralyzed, I would be able to work because I could communicate and I can do what I'm trained to do. Certain manual jobs I certainly wouldn't be able to do. But there's always something that somebody can do. There are organizations that actually created jobs for disabled people to restore lost dignity. And they do amazing jobs. You know, some of this low discretion stuff where they don't have to think too hard about the jobs, but they will come in there and they will do it day after day after day, faithfully doing the job that's required of them. So certainly we don't look down on them, but I do believe that they can still work unless they are really out of it. Okay. How should an employer serve his staff to encourage them to have a good work ethic? Well, he needs to set a good example. If your employer is lazy, he's not going to have a business too long. He needs to set the example. Certainly up until the last couple of years, I used to get to my business long before my staff and leave after they did. It wasn't anything else other than to show them that I was working hard. I needed to set an example. The quality of the work that I produce needs to be excellent, and they need to see that. I don't have to tell them, but then I need to actually show them that. The one thing that I've slipped up on is actually saying, whatever I'm doing is as unto the Lord. Okay. To get that focus right. And that's something I've now written onto a page, and I'm going to stick up in my office so that every morning when I walk out of that office door, it's going to stare me in the face. Have you done today as unto the Lord? Okay. There was another part to that. What are the do's and don'ts? Okay. I think just setting a good example really is very important. Can I say something about tithing? I'm not sure that tithing has got much to do with work other than, you know, whatever you do, you're doing as unto the Lord. As a result of your work, if you're employed, you receive a salary. Tithing is a Hebrew concept. It's in the Old Testament. It was certainly one of the Mosaic laws. The word tithe actually means 10%. The early Hebrews actually were encouraged to give more than that. In fact, if you look at what they used to give, it worked out to about 23.2% of their income that they would give. And most of their tithing was to give essentially to the Levites, the priesthood, and also for the poor, and they were encouraged to do so. So that is the Old Testament. Now, in the New Testament, there's no specific word there that says you must tithe. What Paul does say in his letter to the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, he speaks on giving, and he speaks in particular about generous giving, is that we need to give, A, with a cheerful heart, and we need to give generously. Generously. In fact, it's almost a sign that you've been redeemed. If before you were redeemed as a Hebrew, you gave 10%, surely after you're redeemed, you should even want to give more. That's what Paul was saying, come on, guys. God has blessed you. Jesus, he has blessed you enormously. You can actually give a lot more. And I think in the New Testament, we encourage people, certainly on the money course that we've just done, I've encouraged people, I've said, folks, Give to the level at which you become uncomfortable. Give to the extent that it disturbs your comfort zones. If you're earning 100,000 rand a month and you're only going to tithe 10%, 10,000 rand off 100 doesn't make you uncomfortable. You still have 90 left each month. But if you're earning 1,000 rand a month, 100 rand makes you seriously uncomfortable. Do you hear what I'm saying? But it's the heart of giving. You need to give to a point where you now need faith to see out the month. There has to be a degree of discomfort. I'm giving this, but, you know, I don't know if I'm going to cut at the end of the month. But you have to give. You must do it. Lord, I'm doing this in faith. I'll give. Does that help you? Any other questions there? What happens when you've been working and you get cheated of a promotion? Not once, but twice. Wow. All right. Let me take you back to that very first quote that I gave you from H. Bertram Lewis. It said, unless the job means more than the pay, it will never pay more. And what Paul is saying here is whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord and not to men. If you're working in a job where, and obviously your boss is the one who promotes you, if the boss has not promoted you, there's one of two things you can ask. Either he doesn't like you and he's favoring somebody else, or you're not promotionable. You're not doing your job. And you are not getting promoted because you don't deserve it. It's one of the either. And I would say that what you need to do is quietly and calmly go and sit down with the boss and say, please would you tell me why this has happened? I would like to know. If I need to sort myself out, then I'll go and do it. But go and find out. Okay? I would think that that's what you need to do. What if one works with people who do not want to work? Should I do all the work myself to please God? Well, first of all, you mustn't associate with those. I remember that word from Paul to the Thessalonians when he said, don't associate with idle people, is written to believers in the church. It's not talking about unbelievers. Okay, so you're going to associate with unbelievers in the workplace. You're going to get the lazy ones, and you're going to get the hardworking ones. And you get people who are there just because they feel entitled in this culture of entitlement. And they have no work ethic. They've been given a job profile, a job title, and it has a pay scale. And so they get to work at 8 o'clock, they sit down at their desk, and they see through the day, the end of the month, they get their pay, and they go home. And if nobody chases them, they will continue like that for years. Man, that is soul-destroying and mind-bending. I would go crazy if I was in that situation. But the fact is, that's what happens. And I think that what you've got to do is, you can't go and do their work. But whatever you're required to do, you need to do it as unto the Lord. And don't worry about them. Don't worry about them. Their time will come. Their time will come. Okay. Another one. All right. Well, some of the questions that I had didn't come up. I just want to raise one or two of them because they are quite important. Let me just find that. I was asked, and I've been asked this a number of times, what if I've tried and tried to get a job and I simply haven't been able to get one? And I've had people sitting desperately in front of me saying, I have tried to get a job. Highly qualified people. The most recent is a chartered accountant. He's in his 50s. He's been unemployed for over 2 years. Highly qualified. He's not a Christian, but he hasn't been able to get a job. His age, and he's also asking for too much money. But the fact is, he hasn't been able to get one. So I said to him, you need to get up in the morning, get dressed as if you're going to work, go out at 8 o'clock, and look for work until 5. Go and look for work as if it was your job, and do it every single day, Monday to Friday. Find a place. Go and find. There is always someone who will give you work to do if you look hard enough for it. You might mean knocking on doors. It might mean sitting on the computer, the internet. You may have to go and visit recruiting agencies, but do that. Don't sit at home waiting for someone to phone you. The second question is, follows on from that, well, what if I've done that and I still haven't been able to get one? That's what this accountant said to me. He said, I've done that. He said, I've been on the internet for hours. I've been to every recruiting agency in the universe. But everybody's got my CV. I can't get a job. What do I do? And this is possible. And I said to him, what you need to do is find the kind of employer that you want to work for. Go to them in that particular skill set and say to them, here I am. For 6 months, I haven't worked. I've been looking for a job for 6 months. For the next 6 months, I'm willing to work for you for nothing. Because in those 6 months I haven't been working, I might as well have worked for you and not get paid. But at least I have the opportunity to show you what I can do. I actually know of someone that's happened to in Canada. This guy is an engineer. He couldn't get a work over there. And eventually he did exactly that. He was working for this company for 2 months. And they said, hey, we're employing you. We don't want to lose you. He was so good at his job. And now he's a senior manager. Whatever you do, do your work heartily. You see, what happens, folks, is when you start doing that, you create momentum. I used that example in the informal settlement area. What happens is that people, once you start doing something, and you finish the task, and you step back and you look at it, and it's good, and you feel better, and your dignity gets raised up, and you create momentum, and the next thing is you go and start a little vegetable garden, and you grow tomatoes, and you can sell those tomatoes to somebody, and you're actually learning about how to grow tomatoes, until you become a tomato expert. And when you're a tomato expert, everybody's coming to you, and now you're charging them for giving them advice how to grow these tomatoes, and next you are running a tomato growing business. But you know what happens? If you don't start by digging that first bit of soil out of the ground and planting that first seed, you'll never get that tomato growing business. You need the momentum. You need to start. I often think if you're walking along the side of a road and a big truck goes past you, and you feel like you're getting sucked after the truck. Isn't that right? That's what momentum does. Once you get into it, it starts, it has a life of its own. And it goes. So don't stop. Whatever you do, work heartily as unto the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as unto the Lord. But let's just all stand, please.